Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. The idea of a podcast was conceived as a way to be able to present content that was developed for the 2020 Dispute Resolution Symposium. That symposium was unfortunately called off for that plan-crushing pandemic called COVID-19. We are using this podcast format so we don't lose that valuable conference content. Today's topic relates to mediation with public officials. We'll talk about the unique perspectives and interests that public officials have in mediation. Public officials listening to this podcast will discover how to make requests to help you govern without fear of litigation. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who may want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Joining me today from this side of the Iron Curtain is Mark Landeth, Esquire. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for the Iron Curtain reference. I don't get that every day.
I brought that up because you had an early career experience with the military. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. One of my first jobs as a lawyer was with the JAG Corps, and I got assigned to a cavalry unit that was stationed in West Germany, but the nearest unit to our unit was an East German unit with staff with Soviets and binoculars, and between us and them were two bands of razor wire with hungry-looking German shepherds in between, and the occasional white cross where somebody had tried to come to freedom and didn't make it.
Wow. What kind of work were you doing there?
So I got to be prosecutor. It was a community of about 17,000 people. My first trial, I was the only English-speaking lawyer in 50 miles other than the judge and my opposing counsel. And everything that came in the door, I got to do. And because the cavalry, you know, as sort of a life's work, is made to kill people and break things, they were really good generators of work for a prosecutor. So I had murders and rapes and robberies and even a little espionage because it was the border.
Wow. And just thrown into that as a newbie attorney too, right?
Yeah, I don't think I hurt anybody.
Oh, I'm sure you did fine. And then you were a civil litigator at the Pentagon?
Yeah, so I kind of went from the teeth of the monster to the back end, if you will. So instead of being on the front, I was at the back. And so they had a kind of an A-team of lawyers who would swoop in anytime the government, or the Army or Department of Defense was sued anywhere in the country, in federal court typically. And we would fly out and represent the government when they got sued.
It all sounds very high clearance level.
Yeah, there was some of that. There was some of that. And they were interesting cases. I remember driving to work one day, and on the radio, they talked about a guy who had, just retired from Aberdeen Proving Ground, and they opened his personal safe and found records that the Army had been giving psilocybin to unknowing mental patients in the 50s to see what would happen, to see if it would be a good weapon of choice in the Cold War. And, you know, it sounds like something somebody made up, but in fact, it was true. And it turned into litigation in Manhattan that I got to go to and go to trial.
Oh my gosh, that sounds incredible. And you got to go across the whole country in that job too.
Yeah. So a lot of the action happens in Leavenworth. That's where the soldiers go when they're sentenced. And a lot of them don't tell their parents, you know, it's like we get letters. Why won't you let my son, you know, come home for Christmas? He's been stationed at Leavenworth. Well, yeah, he's stationed. All right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. All right. And then what was your next career step after that?
So I thought about getting out. I was actually a recruiter for the Army. It's the largest employer of lawyers next to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
I did not know that.
So it requires constant feeding. And so so I did, I was the guy that interviewed people that wanted to get in and help decide who got in and who didn't. I did that for a little while. It was actually too easy. I thought I wanted an easy job in the government, but it was agitating at 5 o'clock to go home. So so I joined private practice with a firm called Isaac Brandt, and we merged 7 years ago with the Wiles firm, and we're Isaac Wiles. And I've been in town practicing law since 1987.
Well, tell everybody a little bit about that firm. What does your law firm focus on?
Yeah, we don't do murders, rapes, and robberies anymore, which was kind of fun back in Germany. But we do we do a lot of litigation. We represent all the restaurants that you used to like to go to. And we have a good group of people that represent developers and restaurants and businesses. And we do estate planning. We do divorces for the stars, so to speak. It's hard to talk about a divorce practice without mentioning names, and I don't want to mention names, but all the cool people you know. And we do a lot of public sector stuff as well. So I've gotten a chance to represent, I think, every county in Ohio, all the cool suburbs around town, 110 school districts, a lot of townships. So it's kind of like the Globetrotters, you know, we don't have a home game, but we try to win every time anyway.
Well, and you serve as special counsel for a former boss of mine. Dave Yost is now the Ohio Attorney General, but years ago, he was my employer at the Delaware County Prosecutor's Office and gave me my first job out of law school. So shout out to Mr. Yost today.
How was that? He might hear this, so...
I loved starting as a prosecutor. Just like you said, you get your feet wet real quick and you get in the courtroom immediately. And it is an amazing experience in preparation and thinking on your feet. Yeah, can't beat it.
Well, I met him representing Delaware County and got to know him that way. And so I've been really interested to see what he's done. He's a very neat guy. You know, he doesn't look at things in the usual way and take them for granted. He tries to take them apart and figure out how to make them better. And that's pretty cool.
I agree with that assessment. How did you become interested in alternative dispute resolution?
It's hard not to be when you're a litigator. When you're a civil litigator, I'm going to paraphrase a guy named Bob Nichols, a judge in Madison County. We've gone away from a system where we use the engine of truth, cross-examination, to determine culpability. And instead, we use a more holistic model where we ask the question, who is harmed and who has money to pay for it? And as a result, judges don't really think of themselves as there to do trials and let the jury system sort it out. They look for a way to resolve disputes earlier than that. So it's almost impossible to be a civil litigator without spending most of your time thinking about this instead. I guess I'd add that in the polite Midwest, which you could also sometimes call the passive aggressive Midwest, we don't like to say nasty things to each other. And so we would prefer to give that to an intermediary and let them say nasty things to our opponents. So we're kind of made for mediation here in Ohio.
Well, I think it's great that we have you on this topic today because you've seen both sides of public official mediation, both as a neutral and as an advocate for public officials participating in mediation. So you can give us an inside scoop on both, right?
I will do my best. I'm sure with your probing questions, I can't not.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks.
You were all set to present on mediation with public officials at the symposium. So you're ready to try that topic right now? Ready to try that on this podcast platform today?
It was like I had my prom dress on and nobody asked me to dance. Aww. It was very sad.
It was like the day the pandemic started and canceled everything was the day of the symposium. So it was a huge, like, what the heck for all of us.
We
did not know this new world yet.
Yeah, we were as disappointed as the bodybuilders down the street at the Arnold.
Right, the Arnold got canceled like 2 days before. That's right.
That's, yeah.
It was our Arnold as mediators. It was our Arnold classic. Yes, it was.
We were ready to flex in public.
We were. Yeah. All right. Well, let's dive right in, I guess.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What are some examples of times when public officials would be involved in a mediation?
So they get sued a lot. And the ones that are pretty experienced at it take it kind of as a business-like item. Not all of them. The people that are in law enforcement tend to think of the justice system as a way to mark conduct as good or bad. And they see litigation, so even civil litigation, as sort of that kind of threat. And the resolution of it's very important to them so that they don't feel marked as you would in the criminal system. So you have to think about that part of it. So they, typically we have the usual kinds of torts, car crashes and all that kind of stuff, but public officials can get into much more interesting things. Land use battles and constitutional questions of the ability to use their authority or not, and both Ohio and U.S. constitutional issues. Use of force cases are interesting. I've got a case now where my guy shot somebody 21 times during a search warrant. It's got a lot of Breonna Taylor in it. And, those kind of cases are there and need to be resolved. And governments need to be able to govern without fear of litigation as well. They need to not have litigation drive policy when it shouldn't.
So the Supreme Court of Ohio has a program called Government Conflict Resolution Services, and it offers practical assistance in resolving and preventing conflict among public officials on whatever matters are in front of them. What benefits do you see to the public officials from programs like that?
That's a good program because you have a hope that the public officials that are supposed to work together toward good government for a locality, let's say commissioners and judges. Judges sometimes announce their budget in an entry that says, this is what money I want. The commissioners, on the other hand, have the responsibility of making sure that everything gets budgeted and everything gets paid. And their main policy goal is to spend money in the way that benefits the county. So they might tell the prosecutor how much they get and the recorder and the auditor and the sheriff, but they get a court entry from the common pleas judge, who oftentimes don't see that as anything unusual. You know, that's how they speak. But commissioners don't take it that way. So a good example would be a funding dispute, or I want a new courtroom if you're a judge, or there are certain kinds of outfits, veteran services commissions, sometimes boards of elections, that often also raise issues of funding that need to be resolved. There are also cases where judges have disputes with other judges about who gets to sit where and who gets the parking space and more grave things than that. But I'm speaking in euphemism because I don't want to talk about a current case.
Right. Is having just the impartial third party, does that just really help these conflicts from escalating and getting into the press or getting more contentious than they have to be? I mean, I think that there's a lot of duty involved in public service, and there's a lot of, publicity involved. So it becomes a little touchy.
Right. I try to litigate cases so that when I leave the county, the situation is ripe for further conversation between the people that ought to be speaking, so that they don't need a lawyer to speak. And you try to leave people in a place that they can govern without lawyers hanging around when you're gone. Your comment about the publicities is an important one with that particular program. It is not necessarily, unless there is an agreement, it's not confidential. So one of the first things to negotiate if you have one of those parties is, will it be confidential? The people that are adept at using local press as leverage on other public officials in town often don't want it to be private. They want the mediation to be another step in their campaign of PR and leverage to get their way. And so it can be important for the advocate to recognize that and determine whether or not those conditions are acceptable for their clients.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be a landmine. Well, how do you address it?
Yeah, here's one way. One way is to get into a lawsuit. As silly as that sounds, but if you have a lawsuit and the court orders mediation, which a lot of courts will tell you that's kind of an oxymoron, but if they order mediation, then all of a sudden the terms of the mediation are dictated by the court, which would include confidentiality. So if I have a client that ought to be in that mediation, but I've got a dispute as to whether or not it should be private, I will ask the court to order it.
All right, cool workaround. All right, so confidentiality, publicity, that's one thing about public officials. What else do mediators need to know about public officials?
Well, even sociopaths would be wise to start with.
I thought that was going to start. Okay, go ahead.
It would be wise to start with empathy. So it probably works for mediators too. So let's think about what public officials care about. And public officials care about what people will say about what they're doing. You know, they've got to go to the Rotary Club and the Grange Hall and church and Kroger's and talk to people about what happened. And so how it comes off and what they're able to say at the end of the resolution is very important to them. The second thing is, especially if money's being asked for, and we should talk about third-party payers at some point, but let's assume that it's a county that's going to pay out of its own general fund. They need to be able to explain why that was a good use of that money as opposed to something else. You know, the 4-H wants support too. There are very few places in most local governments that there is discretionary spending. So if they discretionary spend for this case, it's something they can't fund somewhere else. And so they need to be able to explain why that was a better idea. And I guess the third thing I'd want a mediator to think about by way of empathy for the public official is sort of the public official's desire to support the discretion of the office. Not so much themselves, but if litigation is going to make a policy choice, it means that an elected public official didn't. And so oftentimes the public official will be want to be a good steward of the power of that office. And they'll think about that as regards to what choices are made in mediation.
And should the mediator do any research on these public officials or politicians before the mediation?
Well, they're public people, so there would be things that are available. You know, I'm selling a house now, and it strikes me that eventually we'll all be able to see every room in each other's houses, right? They take 80 pictures of your house and they put it online and it stays there forever. So I think we can learn a lot about each other. But as far as public officials go, I think it makes sense to do a Google search of the news. There's not as much local news as there used to be. Mm-hmm. And those have long-ranging effects that is probably a podcast for another day, but I think that makes sense. I think that open-ended questions in caucus might get you something too. I think that's worthwhile. If you need to take the lawyer out and say, what do they really care about? Because you think you're getting woofed by the public officials, I would advise the mediator to do that.
Let's talk more about that caucus idea. How would you do that?
So I'm back to the Play Midwest. I don't like joint sessions. You know, typically the shorter the joint session, the better. There is, if a mediator starts a mediation with an unstructured open session, it leads most advocates to want to advocate. And it leads most advocates to want to give an opening statement that speaks for the soul of their client, which is sometimes good. But in that situation, it creates an atmosphere that is far away from an atmosphere conducive to resolution. It has them spitting across the table at the other side. And so oftentimes, particularly when I'm on the defense, I tell my clients ahead of time, if we have an open session and the mediator says what this case is about, and the other side gives this long, nasty, you know, diatribe against you, please know I'm not going to respond in kind. And I'm not going to respond in kind because it doesn't lead to an atmosphere conducive to a resolution of the case, which is why we're here. And also, they haven't bought my opening statement yet. I don't know if this case is going to settle or not going to settle. There are secondary kinds of interests in mediation. If you don't settle, you find out what the price would be. And you also get a lot of free discovery. And I'm not going to give that up in that opening session. And so please know that I'm using all of my skill and experience by shutting up. And if you don't do that, they think, does my lawyer know my case? Does my lawyer believe in my case?
Right. You got to tell them the game plan ahead of time so they're not like poking you during the whole mediation. Yeah. Like, step in, say something. Yeah, you're like, this is all part of the strategy. Be cool.
we're good. And they're talkers too. So they, you know, they might start yelling at the other side too.
So if there's public officials listening to the podcast, do you have any tips for those public officials as they're going into this, just being prepared for the mediation process itself? What kind of advice do you typically, besides for what you've already said, is there other advice that you give to your public official clients?
Yeah, I think that you know, a lot of them think that they've got the right position and there's not even a position prime that's close to the original position that would be acceptable. And obviously, if you're going into mediation, it makes sense to think about the other positions you might take that can get you to yes. It's okay to say these things are off limits. I'm not rehiring this person. You know, they're going to be toxic for the workplace, especially after they've been fired. You know, we fired this person because of complaints of retaliation. We'll have, you know, bad morale and bad conduct in that office if we put that person back in. You know, it's okay for them to say that's a non-starter. But if you do that, you know that it's going to cost more money. Mm-hmm. And you have to be ready to do that, or at least talk about it.
Is there anything public officials might want to hide from mediators that could actually help them? Like examples that you might have seen where they're not wanting to talk, but if they would give some information, it could really help the case?
I think it's important for the mediator to know everything that the public official cares about. And you ought not be ashamed of it. And it may be, you know, those things that somebody would think are silly. You know, I don't want this other public official to think badly of me, or, you know, I don't want this used in the next campaign, or I don't want this used as leverage against me for this other issue I care about. You know, and I think laying that all on the table would be a good thing for both the mediator and the client. This assumes that your mediator is good at figuring out when not to tell people the things that happen in caucus.
And public officials might not be telling you everything if you're on the other side of the table. If you're the mediator, they might not be telling you everything you need to know to resolve a case. And how do you deal with that from that side, from the mediator side, if you kind of feel like these people are keeping these cards too close to their vest, we're not going to get anywhere? What's your strategy as a mediator to get through that?
Yeah, I'm back to empathy. You know, I've been thinking about your position, and I could see where, you know, you're up for election this year, and you know, you need to think really hard about what this looks like when we get this successfully resolved today. So let's keep in mind all the time what kind of communications come out at the end of this resolution. And I want your help to make sure that I get everything I need to know from you, client, defendant, whoever it might be, to make sure that we craft the best message we can at the end of this.
And I think we talked before the podcast, and a question that you told me that you often consider is, what are you worried about? And I think that goes back to that question of empathy. Why is that a good question to think about? What are you worried about? How do you use that question as a mediator?
Yeah, I use that question with my kids and the guy that's doing my HVAC. So it's a good question everywhere, really. It's open-ended enough to let people tell you what they're thinking without letting them know what you expect to say. And so that one, and predict the future for me. Those questions have been working pretty well.
Predict the future for me. Okay, tell me how that one works.
Well, if, let's say the client might ask the mediator that. Predict the future for me. What's going to happen? And that you might find out that the mediator is going to tell you something about what they learned in the other caucus room. Well, I think they'll react to your offer this way. And then you can be planning your next move. It also tells you what people want to have happen, because they tell you their hopes and dreams.
All right. So you had told me a trick that you had learned from med mal cases, and I want you to explain that to people, because I think that's very helpful in these cases. Can you talk about
that?
Thank
you. Yeah, it goes back to the sort of person that, especially a law enforcement person. So let's say you have a case where the individual policemen have been sued in the city. In med mal, they used to sue doctors and hospitals. And in order to get the doctor to sign off on the settlement, if it was a consent to settle clause in an insurance policy or just for the reputation of the doctor, they would negotiate for the doctor to be dismissed, then payment to be made by the hospital, and a dismissal entry would show a settlement by the hospital so that the doctor could say, yeah, I got sued once, I got dismissed. And in the same way, you can do the same thing with policemen. You can do the same thing with commissioners or city councilmen or anybody else you're representing. Negotiate for their early dismissal. It takes a bit of trust on the other side, but if you lay out that that's what's going to happen, there's going to be a flat out dismissal without any apparent conditions. Then there's going to be a payment of money by the entity, the city, county, what have you. And a settlement with a release of everybody, including the people that have already been dismissed. So the cops, let's say, get the benefit of the deal, but they also get something extra. They get a public recognition that they were dismissed before the settlement actually occurred.
So if somebody in the future says, have you ever been sued? You can say, I was dismissed from that case.
Yep. I got sued, but I got dismissed. What happened afterwards? Cop will say, in my experience, the cop will say, I don't know.
No, no. I was out of it. Who knows?
Yeah, that's right. Right. Why would I care?
Right. All right. So when you're doing mediation with public officials, what is the importance of getting these mediation agreements in writing?
Yeah, so I guess maybe that's two-part with government. It's always good to get it in writing, and we do a lot of this stuff remotely now, and so it's hard to put pencil and paper in front of people and have them sign it before we walk out of a warm room that's got the smell of tension in it, which happens, used to be the standard. The problem to work out, and you'll see this sometimes, the mediator, the first thing they'll say is, everybody agree that this is all confidential. And one of the things I think an advocate should think about is whether or not you want to claim an exception. If in fact you have a deal, everybody should be able to say what the deal is. And I've had cases in which at the end of the deal, somebody tries to walk away. The attorney can't say what their client told them to do or not to do. And the mediator claims privilege. So you're left with no proof of what the deal is unless you've got something in writing. Having said that too, you also have the issue, an extra issue with the government, because nothing's final until proper action's taken in the public. In order to preserve, you know, democracy and all that good stuff, we have public meetings at which actions happen in public after public debate. And so having decisions made in the mediation aren't final until the public body formally acts. So the both sides have to be aware that anything happens in a mediation, if it includes a promise by the government, it's conditional until it's finally done. And that can go terribly wrong. So we settled a case, a land use case for a county. It was a landfill that wanted to come to your neighborhood, always popular, right up there with, you know, Trader Joe's. So the people were, you know, excited about it. And the settlement occurred subject to final approval. And one of our lawyers is walking in thinking he's going to go into executive session, explain the deal, they'll vote for it. And the person behind him going into the courthouse was carrying a camera. And where are you going? Well, the commissioners are voting on something today. Oh, you know, we turn the corner and in the quiet hallway, it's not quiet at all. There's 110 people. And the commissioner says, yeah, we'll give you a Q&A for an hour and a half with the lawyer about why we should do this deal. And, you know, they pitchforks come out and the commissioners vote against it.
Wow. Yeah, that just blew up a lot of planning.
Yeah, so watch out.
Is there any question to timing of approvals as far as how these agreements get done?
Yeah, I guess I would circle back to the fact that you need to get final approval and it needs to be in public if there's a promise from the government. So you got to build that into the timing of when you think you're going to have a final resolution. And you might think about how that plays with the press and the public. You know, is there a contested election? Maybe you want to have that meeting after that. You know, are there going to be new people take over 2 out of 3 spots on the Board of County Commissioners? You know, maybe you want to get it done before that happens. So you have to always think about who your decision maker is, because it's not static.
Right. Yeah, that could throw a wrench in everybody's ideas. So yeah, that makes total sense to do that. I want to give you a chance to go back. You wanted to address third-party payers.
Right. So in the 80s, the Supreme Court took away all immunity. And the result was that, for instance, all of the sheriff's cruisers in Adams County were parked because the private insurers left the marketplace and Adams County was uninsured. 6 counties, so having said that, the General Assembly, having seen that and municipal swimming pools that were locked up and fireworks that didn't go off on the 4th of July because nobody wanted to take any risks, they responded by putting some immunity back, but also allowing public political subdivisions to band together and basically insure each other. So they would be self-insured together in a pool. So they would have less risk total by sharing the risk together. And so, for instance, 6 brave counties met at Kings Island in 1987 and started a pool of counties, which now has, I think, 67 members out of 88 counties. So those guys take money, public money, and they pool it, and they hire lawyers to defend cases and make decisions about when to settle and that sort of thing. The same is true for schools. The same is true for cities. There's some of them that are mixed with cities and counties and townships. And so there are pools, and there are still some private insurers. And so oftentimes, you're not necessarily dealing, the decision maker may not be a public official. Mm-hmm. It may in fact be a professional like an insurance adjuster, except it's not really insurance, that makes those decisions. Because there's only a finite number of people who can be members of the club, they tend to think really hard about what does that county or city or township want? It may not be a contract term that they have to sign off, but practically speaking, they want the public official to be happy with the outcome of the case. And so you've got to sell not only the claims professional, but also everybody in the city or county or township that it's a good idea. But that does allow one thing that can help the plaintiff in these cases, the claimant. If you have a settlement where all that happens is money gets paid, you don't have to do anything in public. You don't have to go to the county commissioner's meeting. You don't have to, you know, there's a third party that writes you a check. Your client signs a release and you're done. Mm-hmm. So I try whenever I can to have just a one party release and not a two party settlement in order to streamline the process and give certainty so that it doesn't blow up later.
Well, we're getting near the end, but I want to make sure if you had any more tips for public officials, as that was the billing of this podcast. So in case you had any last tips to throw out there for public officials who are going to be doing a mediation or litigation.
Thank you. I would say one thing to think about, if you have a case that asks for action instead of money, you know, I want you to change your jail and how, you know, I want you to build a new jail. I want you to staff it more, or I want everybody that comes in to get a driver's license to get papers on how to apply for Medicaid, or, you know, there's lots of stuff like that. Voting, a lot of election kind of lawsuits. You know, I want somebody to go into the jail and register everybody in the jail and make sure they get an absentee ballot. And 100% of them vote on election day. When you've got a policy request like that, you know, do you want to give up that kind of discretion? And do you want a court order telling you what to do? And if you get into one of those court orders, think about what the end game is. You've got to be concerned with how long that lasts, whether or not there's monitoring, whether you end up paying lawyers to continue with a consent decree for years afterward, whether the situation changes so it stops making sense, the thing that you agreed to one day and the court sort of maybe even bludgeoned into you may stop making sense pretty soon. And it tends to calcify policy in ways that are not good for the public.
All right. And now at the end of every podcast, I've got this bit that I like to do, and it's called 2 for me and 1 for you. So I'm going to subject you to this as well. So there's going to be 2 questions for you as the presenter, and then 1 question that you will have for our audience as a pop quiz to see if they were paying attention today.
Okay.
All right. Question 1's for you. What is an interesting and relatively brief mediation related story that you can share?
Well, this comes under the heading of too good to fact check. So I can't say this is true, but two churches were suing each other in a small rural county, and the mediator came to what he thought was a brilliant conclusion, and the one party said yes, and the other party says, we're going to have to pray on this. And they were brought into the courtroom that was empty and were praying, and allegedly the mediator cracked the door open just a little bit. And while people were looking up to heaven with their eyes closed and holding hands in a circle, he whispered, take the money. Take the money.
Okay, thank you. Oh my gosh.
You probably heard that a million times, huh?
I had not heard that. That is hilarious. Okay, question 2. Who is an amazing person you know related to mediation or law field, and why do you appreciate them?
Well, I've done a lot of stuff with Frank Ray. We kid here that we do a lot of litigation here, and we feel like Frank too.
I like him.
And then we, you know, he should have his own parking space. And part of that is something that a mediator can replicate. Part of it isn't, but part of it is. And if you think a lot of the private mediators that are busy, they tend to be affable people that you wouldn't mind spending time with. They tend to be reasonable listeners. But here's the other thing. They tend to be plaintiff lawyers. Defendants often have lots of cases. Plaintiffs often have only one. They don't know the system. All they know is they don't want to be taken advantage of. So if you can get a mediator that can say, I've been your lawyer before in cases like this. And your lawyer's telling you the truth and you ought to do this. That can oftentimes get a case to yes that wouldn't otherwise get there. And I think that's part of the secret sauce for Frank and others like him.
He was on my podcast. He has already recorded it with me. So if anyone wants to hear more from Frank Ray, he's on episode 2.
All right. He's a good dude.
He is. All right. Now it's your turn to give the audience a knowledge check. What's a pop quiz question you can give to them? What should they know after listening to your podcast?
I would ask them, if you are settling with a public official or a political subdivision or the state, and you come to an agreement at mediation, is it a done deal?
All right. Good question. All right. I want to give you a chance. Is there any closing remarks you want to make before we go that you didn't get to talk about today, or anything you wanted to say before we wrap up?
No, thanks for doing it. You're good at this.
Oh, thank you. You're good at this too. All right. Well, that's a wrap for today. A huge thank you to Mark Landis for his informative presentation about public officials and mediation. And thank you to everyone who's listening, especially those of you out there working for justice. I hope you all join us for our next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast. Until then, stay healthy.